Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Peter Breen of the Thomas More Society, a public interest law firm. On behalf of defendants David and Joan Farley, with me as co-counsel is Randall Wenger of the Independence Law Center, also a public interest law firm. Mr. Wenger will argue the constitutional and related issues, and I will address the remainder. Your Honor, might it be possible for us to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal at the conclusion of the other presenters?
Certainly.
Thank you, Your Honor. Much has been made of the word spouse here, and that is very important. But more important is how this retirement plan defines that word. The retirement plan defines the word spouse as the person to whom the plan participant was married to for the year prior to her death. At the time of Ellen Farley's death in September of 2010, her Canadian marriage license with Jennifer Tobitz was invalid in both Pennsylvania, where her employer is headquartered, and in Illinois, where she lived. Ms. Farley was not married for 1 year prior to death. The invalidity of that license in both Pennsylvania and Illinois thus defeats Ms. Tobit's claims. This case involves a retirement plan, a private contractual relationship between an employer, Cozen O'Connor, and its employee, a 37-year-old litigator, Ellen Farley. The plan participant, Ms. Farley, designated her parents, David and Joan Farley, as her plan beneficiaries and died shortly thereafter. Defendant Jennifer Tobitz claims that she is the same-sex spouse of Ms. Farley and has claimed the plan benefits are hers by right, as she never consented to the beneficiary designation in favor of Mr. and Mrs. Farley. The default beneficiary order provided by the plan is first to the spouse, then to the children, and then to the parents of the plan participant. For this reason, whether or not the beneficiary designation form is valid, the issue of whether Ms. Tobitz is a spouse under the terms of the plan is dispositive, for either her consent as spouse was required for Ellen Farley to designate her parents as beneficiaries, or her status as spouse allows her to jump in line ahead of Ellen's parents in the default beneficiary order provided by the plan. However, this designation form, while not dispositive, does highlight the danger of Ms. Tobitz's position. If this court accepts Ms. Tobitz's position today, it will be doing violence to the dying wishes of Ellen Farley by stripping Ellen's parents of funds that Ellen intended for them. The plan by its terms is to be construed according to Pennsylvania law. Pennsylvania law is clear that persons of the same sex cannot be married. But the same result is worked by Illinois law, where Ellen Farley resided. Persons of the same sex in Illinois cannot be married. And finally, by its terms, this private plan invokes and seeks the recognition of several federal laws, including ERISA, the IRS code, and those federal laws are governed by the Defense of Marriage Act, which itself defines the word spouse in marriage as exclusively unions of one man and one woman. Now, constitutional issues have been raised in this case, but it is the Farley's position that they're peripheral to the private contract issue here, and thus they need not be reached, because there is no law that stood in the way of Cozen O'Connor and Ellen Farley contracting as they saw fit. It is beyond peradventure that Cozen O'Connor could have provided default benefits to same-sex partners. It is beyond peradventure that Ellen Farley could have designated Jennifer Tobitz as her beneficiary. Now, Your Honor asked several questions in his order. And we want to get to those very specifically, and we'll do them one at a time. And so point A was whether the Cozen plan's choice of law provision impacts the definition of spouse, and if so, whether Illinois or Pennsylvania law should be utilized. We want to remind the court that the rule of decision here, as laid out in Kennedy versus Plan Administrator, a case previously cited to the court, was where the U.S. Supreme Court reaffirmed that ERISA requires a plan administrator act solely in accordance with the plan documents. In that case, the court stated the estate's claim, quote, stands or falls by the terms of the plan. Here, the word spouse is actually defined in the plan. That's in section 1.55A, and I'll read it out. The person to whom that spouse is defined, the person to whom participant has been married throughout the one-year period ending on the date of participant's death. The plan administrator may rely on the participant's written statement regarding such participant's marital status. Close quote. Now, there is an issue here because Cozen O'Connor noted that Ms. Farley's written statements to Cozen always indicated that she was single, even after the 2006 Canadian marriage license was obtained. But again, as we noted, more important than the definition of the spouse is the word married. Now, in Section 9.3 of the plan, it said specifically that it is to be construed by under Illinois law. Now, Ms. Tobitz claims that the plan states Pennsylvania law. Ms. Tobitz claims that Pennsylvania law doesn't control, but instead it's Illinois. Again, we would hearken back to the Kennedy case and say Pennsylvania law controls this private contract under its choice of law provision. But either way, the result is the same. As noted earlier, Pennsylvania DOMA states, the Defense of Marriage Act, states that marriage is between a man and a woman. And in Illinois, Ms. Tobitz and Ms. Farley were not married. There is a civil union law in Illinois. However, that civil union law wasn't even debated until after Ms. Farley's death. It wasn't even debated until after Ms. Tobitz made her claim for benefits to Cozen O'Connor. And certainly wasn't even effective until June of 2011, well into the controversy before this court today. Now, there has been a claim made by Ms. Tobitz that the civil union law in Illinois was somehow retroactive so as to take this deceased person who had a null and void Canadian marriage license and that it would somehow breathe life into that license after the death of the party. We respectfully contend that that is not a meritorious position. And no matter whether it was retroactive or not, they weren't married, as the plan dictates. In Illinois, Illinois law still states, even after the civil union law, that, quote, the following marriages are prohibited. And I'm quoting now from 750 ILCS 5/212, subsection A, subsection 5. So again, the following marriages are prohibited. A marriage between two individuals of the same sex. And then 750 ILCS 5/213.1, a marriage between two individuals of the same sex is contrary to the public policy of this state. So from that perspective, even though the civil union law in Illinois may have been intended to allow individuals rights under Illinois law that were accorded to spouses, they did not change whether one could be married or not in Illinois as same-sex individuals. And a quick Google search, the court could take judicial notice of the fact there is now a same-sex marriage bill that has been proposed in the General Assembly in Illinois, and of course, they wouldn't need one had it already been the law of the state. Now, there is also an aside that we cited to the court more recently that even in Canada, the Canadian government had recently taken a position that their marriage licenses issued to individuals for whom a same-sex marriage was illegal at home, that those marriage licenses are invalid, even in Canada.
That's the position the Attorney General of Canada took, correct?
Correct. And now there's been a continued statement by the government that, well, we're going to fix it. So they've got a bill in the legislature, proposed bill C-32, to amend their Civil Marriage Act. So from that perspective, you know, also the court could take judicial notice of the pendency of that act and say, well, they wouldn't need that act if those marriages were actually valid. So you're looking at a marriage license that was invalid even by the Canadian government standards, invalid under Illinois law, and invalid under Pennsylvania law. So from that perspective, there's no way, there's no traction here that should be given to Ms. Tobitz for that invalid license. Moreover, the issue of ERISA has been large over this case. And the plan mirrors ERISA in the way that it defines spouse as someone to whom the individual has been married for the year prior to death, and that shows an intent to conform specifically in the plan to ERISA and the other federal laws. So from that perspective, ERISA does loom large here, and we'll talk about that later. Ms. Tobitz claims that there are certain that ERISA somehow preempts the state law in this area, but we would again harken back to the cases we cited that there is no federal law of federal common law of marriage, and so the Boggs versus Boggs case and Egelhoff versus Egelhoff, those dealt with state laws that directly conflicted with the spousal rights under ERISA. And in this case, the state law here doesn't do that, but is perfectly consistent with ERISA. And moreover, certainly there's no requirement under ERISA that same-sex partners be covered, and that hasn't been argued by any party. Now, we'd like to go to the court's point B, which is whether the Cozen Plan's definition of the word spouse is ambiguous, and it deals with extrinsic evidence. Its reasons already given, we've pretty well defined the word spouse, and particularly we cited to the Baldwin case, Baldwin versus University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, 636 F. 3rd, 69, pinpoint site 77. That's a Third Circuit case from 2011. That case explained that, extrinsic evidence notwithstanding, quote, the parties remain bound by the appropriate objective definition of the words they use to express their intent. And again, whether Pennsylvania law or Illinois law are the appropriate law here, they both provide the same answer to the court. And this is where we wanted to talk a little more about how ERISA impacts this. It's not that ERISA dictates to the plan requires by federal law that the plan be one man, one woman. It's that the plan, if it wants to come under the protection of ERISA, get the benefits of ERISA, then it conforms to that definition. So when we are reading it from our perspective here, we look and say, well, the plan looked to ERISA. It looked to federal law. We can say, well, that helps you to define that the plan meant marriage and spouse to be the traditional definitions of one man and one woman. In particular, we had cited a case, and the pronunciation is difficult. It's TKACHIK versus Comerica. And that particular case had stated very specifically, in this case, there is federal common law for an accumulated settled meaning of the term spouse for purposes of ERISA. A spouse is one's husband or wife by legal marriage. So in terms of ambiguity, we think that it's pretty clear. Now, if we may go to the court's point C, what impact, if any, the decisions of the Illinois courts have concerning Ms. Tobit's status as Ms. Farley's heir? This is a little bit of a red herring, Your Honor. It was kind of an issue that popped up in the end, and it's one that does not impact the core dispute here before the court, whether the individuals are married for a year prior to death. That order declaring heirship merely states that Tobit's was a party to a civil union. It was done based on a petition where Ms. Tobit signed and said, I was a party to a civil union with the decedent. From that perspective, there is no record of proceedings. There is no proof of argument. It appears that the court merely took the word of Ms. Tobit's, which on its face is, we would respectfully submit, is wrong, because the other party died prior to the civil union law even being effective. In this case, there's no impact because there's no dispute here as to the actions and identities of the party, at least as to the proceedings here in court today. Ms. Farley and Ms. Tobit's went to Toronto in 2006. They obtained a Canadian marriage license, and then Ms. Farley passed in September of 2010. So those facts are undisputed amongst the parties. The issue as well of who takes under the will is certainly distinct from contract issues here. Tobit's status as an heir in Illinois was not based upon being married in Illinois. It's based on a claim of having some right under the civil union law. And again, there was no determination by that court that the two of them had been married for a year prior to death. Ms. Farley died prior to the bill even being debated on the floor of the Illinois General Assembly. So at that point, Ms. Farley, we don't know what she would have done had June 2011 hit and she were still with us today. I don't know what she would have done in terms of her retirement planning. But again, it's irrelevant because we would contend that the marriage is not legal under Illinois law. Just kind of, if you grant them all their arguments, it still doesn't comport. We wanted to point out, under the plan, there is a section 6.2F. That is where the plan gives its ordering. And that section also notes, in a concluding paragraph, that after the default beneficiary order, that if the beneficiary does not predecease the plan participant but dies before the proceeds can be paid out, the proceeds go to the beneficiary's estate. In other words, if the plan participant dies. So from that perspective, just reading the plan and thinking in the way the plan is thinking, each beneficiary has their own right to the proceeds. And so from that perspective, we would just submit to that to the court. We move on to point D. I think that's beating Illinois law to death. Whether Tobitz has standing to assert a breach of fiduciary duty against Cozen, and whether, assuming arguendo that standing exists, Tobitz has sufficiently alleged it, et cetera. We're only going to address this briefly because this is addressed to the Cozen O'Connor. However, we would just note, in looking for the benefits, again, Ms. Tobitz presented to the plan administrator a marriage license that was null and void, and she's seeking to have Cozen held responsible to tell one of its litigators that a document that she obtained in Canada that has no legal significance in the appropriate jurisdictions here in America, to have them tell her that null and void document is going to have no impact on the way that your plan benefits are distributed out of your retirement plan. This is kind of a one equals one. So, again, we would just point that out and let Cozen handle the rest of that. Part E, whether ERISA dictates the definition of the meaning of spouse and precludes private employers from covering same-sex spouses under their plans. Now, an ERISA plan can benefit same-sex partners. There are many examples of this. There's a footnote, I believe it's footnote one in the Human Rights Campaign's own amicus brief that noted that there's a percentage of ERISA pension benefit plans that benefit same-sex partners. Now, Cozen chose not to do that here. They could have. And again, it bears repeating, Ms. Farley could have named Ms. Tobitz as her default beneficiary. Now, there's also a point here to be made that if...
is there any benefit that naming... Let me put it this way. Is there any benefit that a beneficiary would receive that a spouse would not receive? Or better still, is there a benefit a spouse would receive that a beneficiary would not receive?
Well, the one thing the spouse gets is a right of first refusal. However, when you're looking at matters in this context, one has to ask, how does Ms. Tobitz have a right to that? There's no relationship there that would create such a right. And really, when you look at where the law is, the contract is between Cozen O'Connor and Ms. Farley. And so how Ms. Tobitz comes into the contract, it's kind of tough to figure out how does she have a right to this private contractual relationship when the law does not grant her any right to that private relationship. And Your Honor, it does bear repeating, I don't know if we've said it before, but the plan gains great benefits and would lose those benefits if the definitions of marriage and spouse, if it does not comport with the definitions of marriage and spouse in the Defense of Marriage Act. And both the Farleys and Cozen O'Connor have cited the various provisions of the IRS Code and ERISA that indicate those provisions. Because your plan, in order to comport, has to allow the plan participant great liberty in naming their beneficiary, with that one exception of the spouse having the ability to nix, essentially, the designation of beneficiary. Now, in terms of F, whether the Defense of Marriage Act controls the terms, again, we've explained it's not a matter of the law imposing its control. It's a matter of this private contractual relationship seeking federal benefit by claiming some, by deciding to go under these terms of DOMA, ERISA, and the IRS code. And again, if the plan... we're drawn in a different way where you said, well, same-sex partners, here's where we're going to put you, regular spouses, here's where we're going to put you, et cetera. That would make our lives easier here, but at the same time that the plan is drafted as it was drafted. Now, at this point, with the court's leave, I am going to hand it over to Counsel Wenger, who will continue along.
Thank you.
May it please the court. As to the question of whether this court is precluded from reaching the constitutional issues, it's well settled that courts should refrain from reaching the Constitution if it need not do so. So if there's a way to construe the contract, in a way that's constitutional, it should be so construed. According to DOMA, DOMA's reach is explicitly to federal law. If you read the terms of DOMA or if you look into the legislative history of DOMA. So while DOMA is very useful and illustrative in terms of what is meant in this context by a spouse, it doesn't reach into the contract and control what a private employer could do. So Cozen could have given benefits specifically to same-sex partners. In fact, Ellen Farley could have chosen to benefit her same-sex partner as well. In a real sense, there is no state action here in order to reach the constitutional issue. Quoting from the Supreme Court in Attakees versus Kress, 398 U.S. 144, a state is responsible for the discriminatory act of a private party when the state by its law has compelled the act or commanded a particular result. And that is not the case here, so the constitutional issue need not be reached. However, if we reach the constitutional issue, we believe that Baker versus Nelson is controlling both to the equal protection and due process rights. Baker versus Nelson was an appeal from the Minnesota Supreme Court dealing with whether there was a right to same-sex marriage under equal process, equal protection or due process. The United States Supreme Court dismissed that appeal for want of substantial federal question. Back during that time, prior to 1986, such review from the U.S. Supreme Court was mandatory if a federal question was being raised. So according to Mandel versus Bradley, 432 U.S. 173, quote, summary affirmances and dismissals for want of substantial federal question without doubt reject the specific challenges presented in the statement of jurisdiction and leave undisturbed the judgment appealed from. They do prevent lower courts from coming to opposite conclusions on the precise issues presented. So here we would argue that this court is bound by Baker versus Nelson because it really is at base the same issue, whether there's a due process or equal protection right to same-sex marriage. But even apart from Baker versus Nelson, if we just go through the steps of equal protection, it's subject to rational basis. First, this is not a gender-related claim. Gender typically has to do with treating men better than women or women better than men, such as prohibiting men from nursing school or prohibiting women from going to a military college. But most courts who have looked at the opposite sex definition of marriage have said there's not a gender-related claim. Instead, if we apply sexual orientation as the classification, all 11 circuits are in agreement that sexual orientation claims deserve rational basis, not heightened scrutiny. The Supreme Court itself in Romer only applied rational basis. And besides, the factors necessary to get a quasi-suspect or suspect class don't exist here. We're not dealing with a class that's been, quote, relegated to such a position of political powerlessness as to command extraordinary protection from the majoritarian political process, quoting the Supreme Court in Rodriguez, 411 U.S. at 28. The Supreme Court has recognized political powerlessness as one of the traditional indicia of suspectness. A class must be, quote, politically powerless in the sense that they have no ability to attract the attention of lawmakers, quoting from the city of Claiborne, 473, U.S. at 445. Claiborne dealt with the rights of the mentally disabled. The Supreme Court
a relative term?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, what was that?
Is no a relative term?
I don't believe that no is relative, but if we match it up with the analysis the Supreme Court did in Claiborne, I think it is illustrative, because they said that the mentally disabled were historically discriminated against, but because there was some legislative response to their issues, that they couldn't claim that there was no legislative response. In here, you really can't claim that there's no legislative response. After a letter-writing campaign by the Human Rights Campaign, the president changed his position on DOMA. We've got the United States represented here against DOMA today. Congress repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Maryland and Washington recently passed same-sex marriage. Vermont, New Hampshire, New York, and D.C. did so previously. Rhode Island recently passed civil unions. The first openly gay federal judge was just confirmed by a majority of the U.S. Senate. So it's hard to argue that there's no ability to attract the attention of lawmakers. And really, that was said in the context of, does the democratic system work? And I would argue that the democratic system does work. There is a public debate going on. There's a debate within legislatures themselves on this very issue that would be best not to be circumvented by the judicial system. Additionally, classifications that are treated as suspect, quote, tend to be irrelevant to any proper legislative goal. I'm quoting from Plyer versus Doe, 457 U.S. 202. It's really the unique procreative tendencies of men and women that are exactly what's relevant to the state's purpose in marriage. I'll get into more detail, but I just wanted to point out that the classification really is relevant to the legislative goal. Also, members of quasi-suspect and suspect classes share an immutable characteristic determined solely by accident of birth, quoting from Frontiero. Since the Frederick Douglass Foundation will be getting into that in more detail, and I see that my time is running low, I'm just going to pass over that and leave that to others. DOMA survives rational basis scrutiny. Any legitimate basis will do to uphold the classification under rational basis. However, what Congress actually did say as their primary basis is the basis for upholding marriage. They all tie together. First, channeling the procreation that naturally occurs between men and women into a stable relationship, promoting the ideal that children be raised by both a biological mother and a biological father, and protecting the ideal itself from the unforeseen risks of a redefinition.
What would your argument be if it was heightened scrutiny as the standard?
I believe that the same interests still uphold this under heightened scrutiny, and maybe I should run through the interests themselves because I believe that all three of these are important, are substantially important. And it's really the reason why we've considered marriage to be fundamental from the get-go. The Supreme Court has talked a lot about marriage over the years, and to be clear, when it was talking about marriage, it was always talking about a procreative relationship. When we view marriage, the traditional interest underlying marriage has been not only a union between spouses, but has been very child-centered in terms of protecting the offspring from that union. There's a competing vision now in terms of what marriage is. That competing vision says that marriage is simply governmental recognition of a loving relationship. And same-sex marriage pushes us toward that second competing vision. What that does is undermine the long-standing purposes of marriage in terms of stability, because if marriage is...
Let me just take you back to this issue of ERISA. What you're suggesting essentially is that it is separate but equal because of the ability to have a beneficiary listed in the beneficiary column and a spouse being the default, that spouse being man and woman. Is that correct?
Well, no. I would say that ERISA is illustrative of what the outcome could be, but I believe that a plan could define the terms the way that they wanted to. I don't read anything in ERISA that would prohibit giving benefits within the plan to a same-sex partner. So what we have here is just the private choice of the parties themselves. Marriage is a union that has existed from time out of mind in every culture and every civilization, and it's breathtaking in its universality, and I believe that has to do with the importance in channeling procreative capacity into a recognized relationship and ensuring that children benefit from both their mother and their father. Procreation and child rearing is what folks have talked about marriage being.
I'm more than familiar with that and that argument. Let me ask you in terms of the cases that have been recently decided, the California cases, for example.
As far as Galinsky, I would say that's just simply wrongly decided. First off, it was a different case, and it's distinguishable in that that one was dealing with benefits for a federal government employee, a court employee. This has to do with a private contract. So in that sense, it's very different, where that one necessitated reaching the constitutional issues. This one does not. But I'd also say it was wrongly decided because it didn't rely on Baker versus Nelson, almost completely ignoring Baker versus Nelson arguments. It also didn't follow binding precedent with regard to rational basis. So every state and federal appellate court that has addressed Defense of Marriage Acts has upheld them under rational basis scrutiny. The Perry case recently out of California can be distinguished as well. That case was not dealing with the Defense of Marriage Act, but it was dealing with a constitutional amendment, and the judge writing the opinion was very clear to tightly cabin that and say this has to do with just the specific factual situation, wasn't reaching DOMA or the constitutionality of marriage overall, but a situation where, because the courts had opened up same-sex marriage for a period of time, what becomes the effect then of essentially taking away a right? So that was decided on a very different basis. And again, in this case, we don't really need to reach the constitutional issues. Moving on from procreation and child rearing, I should point out that the history of marriage itself is important. If we look even at the United States Supreme Court cases that have looked at marriage over time, they've always been talking about a union between men and women. And even the language that they use about the survival of the race is not talking about mere loving relationships, but is talking about a procreative relationship, pointing to the uniqueness of the union that that DOMA and Pennsylvania DOMA are both seeking to uphold. And I'd argue as well that fundamental rights under the U.S. Constitution. There's a two-step process regarding fundamental rights. First is a careful description of the asserted rights, and second is looking to see whether they're objectively deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. The question here is whether legal recognition of a marriage between persons of the same sex is part of our history, and far from being an objective part of our history, even the notion that that would change provoked a response, both in terms of the Pennsylvania DOMA, the federal DOMA, other state laws, and other state constitutional amendments. So according to Glucksberg, the history of the law's treatment in this country has been and continues to be one of the rejection of nearly all efforts to permit it. So the right to marry is really something terribly unique. Moving from the federal DOMA to the state DOMA is upheld under the federal constitution for the same reasons as the federal DOMA, both under the federal constitution and the state constitution. State constitution is co-equal in all relevant respects to the federal constitution. There is the state equal rights amendment, but that only has to do with gender classifications, which, as I've argued previously, does not exist here. As to the question, by Your Honor, whether this is redressable, I think that's more addressed to Kozin, but I would point out that it is not redressable, and for that reason, the court should not reach the issue, whether in the abstract we decide that federal or state DOMA is unconstitutional. If it doesn't make a difference to where the plan benefits go, we should not reach the constitutional issues.
All right, Councilman.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.